Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 203, and we're going to take a look at comparing two different kinds of rigs. Basically, my ambulance camper van and my new pickup truck, and I've learned some things and going to share with you. Also going to talk about the danger of using battery-powered drills to put screws in your rig. Don't overdo it. A product review of the most wonderful of creations, the toaster, and a tale from the road about a helicopter and a golf ball, because that's going to be fun. Hey, everyone. Thanks for being here. I have just returned from Africa. Wow, jet lag is a thing. I have to tell you, the flight from Cape Town to Chicago takes about 20 hours with a stop in Atlanta. And whew, yeah, it did a number on me, not to mention the time zone change. And then while I was over there, daylight savings time changed too. So I came back to a whole new world and everything's weird. So, you know, being weird is nothing new for me. So I'm just going to kind of roll with it. But I do want to say a special thank you to those of you who were kind enough to visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go and give me a gallon of diesel so that I may continue this program. And a special shout out to Kent and Erica and Dan the Van Man. Thank you guys very much, as well as to everyone who subscribes on a monthly basis. I do appreciate it. All that money is rolled back into the show in one way or another, and you help me keep going. Now, this week, I want to talk about this weird situation I'm in. It's going to sound like I'm bragging. I don't really understand completely how I got to where I am right now, and I need to make some decisions, and I realize that my decision-making that I have to make is actually useful for folks who are unsure of which way to go in van life. So I'm just going to spill it all out here, and you guys can pick and choose which parts you care about. I mean we own 5 RVs now. 5. We have the 1973 D22 Winnebago Indian that's done up like a tiki shack. We have the 2011 Sprinter 144 ambulance that I've converted into a camper. We have a 1993 Scamp 13 Deluxe, which is waiting for me to renovate it, which won't take too much work. We have the new to us 2018 Airstream 26 RBQ, which is the new thing, the new shiny thing, literally. And the 5th RV that has not been built out yet is a 2019 Ram Classic 1500 STL. Yeah, that's 5. And the situation I'm in right now is that I had to have the truck to tow the Airstream because the Airstream's too heavy to be towed by the trailer. And now I've got this truck. And I've also got the ambulance. And the ambulance has been my daily driver since I got it. And now I've got this truck and I've only got one parking space. So I have to pick which vehicle to drive. And I leave one at home and the other one down on our river property. And it's created this mass confusion. And I'm like, I have too many things. I have too many things. So what makes sense here? If I ever want to move the Airstream anywhere for like maintenance or something, because we're actually not going to use it to travel with, it's going to be kind of like a tiny house, but I need something to tow it with, I need the truck. Now you could argue that I could get rid of the truck and just rent a truck every time I need to move it, but that's not terribly convenient. And having had the truck now for a while, well, I've learned some things that I'm going to share with you. And the van, well, the van's been fine. Oh, the van hasn't been fine. I've been telling you the story about the van all along. Well, let me just get into this comparison I have here. So there's a couple of schools of thought. If I want to go camping now, just me, before I had all these vehicles, I would simply hop in the van and go wherever I wanted. And I had all my stuff with me and it's all built out and I didn't have to think about anything. Put some groceries in, make sure there's some diesel, and hit the road. And I was all set. But now I've got this truck, and when I do the math, the truck is a heck of a lot cheaper to drive than the van. Now, this truck has a 5.7 liter V8 in it that uses gas. In the old days, that would be considered a gas guzzler engine, and you would think, oh, you're going to get such terrible mileage on that. Do you know what I'm actually getting for gas mileage on this truck? When it's empty, not when I'm towing, but when it's empty, 25 miles per gallon. Real 25 miles per gallon. That's what I'm measuring when I travel on the highway in this truck. And that's at gasoline prices. And I did the math, and it costs something like 60% of what it costs to drive the van the same distance. So basically, like, here's an example. In June, I'm going to be driving to Colorado for the Dark Sky event that I always go to, the Rocky Mountain Star Stair. If I take my van, it's going to cost me a few hundred dollars more than if I take the truck. And the truck is more comfortable. It's four-wheel drive. It has a much longer range. Even though it has the 8-foot bed, it's actually shorter than the van, making some parking situations easier. It has seating for three, and it has all these other advantages, where it's gas, it's easier to find gas, gas is cheaper, it's easier to find people to work on it, and I can tow things with it. The only problem is it's the truck is not built out like a camper. So the situation I'm in now is that I think I need to sell the ambulance. I need to sell the van. Because what I'm going to do is build out the back of the truck into a camper so that when I'm traveling by myself and just trying to do miles, I can sleep in the back of the truck and everything's fine. It will never be as comfortable as the van. That is never going to happen. But if I'm doing a longer trip, like I'm going to park somewhere for a few days, or if I'm traveling with my wife, I will simply tow the Scamp. And I think in all scenarios, that works out better than me actually traveling in the ambulance. And I'm having such a hard time wrapping my head around this, because I have this van, it's all built out, it's ready to go, but it costs so much to drive it. And I'm not even talking about repairs or insurance or anything like that. I'm just talking purely about fuel costs, that the truck makes more sense in every way. Now, the van has two things going for it that the truck can never match. The first is that I can stand up in it. I can stand up in the van. I can walk around in there. Even with the bed set up, I can still walk from front to back. And there's a lot more space. The van is simply always going to have more space than the truck, even though it's an 8-foot bed, which is a pretty, that's the long bed. If you're not familiar with pickup truck beds, an 8-foot bed is the old-fashioned kind of long bed pickup truck. They're fairly rare these days. I had to hunt a lot to find this thing. Most of them are 5 foot or 6.5 feet. This is a full 8-foot bed. The van is going to have more space, though, simply because it's so tall. I'm just kind of blown away by this turn of events, which I've created by myself. I mean, all right, it was kind of my wife's fault. She's the one who wanted the Airstream, like, right away, and that's where the truck came from. So what this means for you is there is a big factor to consider if you're concerned about money, is how much it costs to drive these things. And the way I camp, the way I'm doing van life is I do long trips. I frequently drive over 1,000 miles going one way. When I went to VanFest, that was over 1,000 miles. When I go to Colorado, that's over 1,000 miles. I'm going to Texas for the eclipse, that's over 1,000 miles. I mean, that's the way I travel. The cost per mile matters a lot to me. And even though I bought the diesel Sprinter van specifically because it had better fuel mileage than a lot of other vans, it's still costing me a fortune compared to this gasoline truck. There's just no two ways about it. I'm going to have to sell the ambulance. Actually, I don't have to. My wife is encouraging me to keep both. And to me, that seems kind of wasteful because I can't drive both. I can only drive one at a time. And I'm in this weird situation now where I'll have one vehicle up in Chicago and the other vehicle down in LaSalle County. And I'll want something out of it. And I'm like, which vehicle do I have? Oh, no, it's in the other vehicle. That's an hour and a half away. I don't like that. I want to have one vehicle. Looks like the ambulance is going to be on the chopping block probably midsummer, I'm guessing. I still want to do some work to it, and I'm still going to take it down to the eclipse because the truck right now is just an empty bed, and it's going to take a long time before me to make that campable. Although I think I will end up taking the Scamp to Colorado for the Dark Sky event. I have an embarrassment of riches. I'm in a just bizarre situation. It has made it crystal clear to me how much it matters that you do your calculations of your per mile cost if you're somebody who travels long distances. Things that are going to cost you more per mile are obviously a larger vehicle. Four-wheel drive, although for this kind of truck, that doesn't cost me too much. And whether it uses gas or diesel. Diesel, as you have heard me say in recent episodes, gets more miles per gallon than gasoline. But the vehicle's configuration is going to overrun that. Just for numbers, my truck's getting 25 miles per gallon empty. The ambulance gets 16.5 miles per gallon. And again, that's gallons of diesel, which costs significantly more than gasoline. Plus, I also have to add diesel exhaust fluid, which has a cost per mile as well. There's really no competition. And bizarrely, to my feeble little mind, the diesel vehicle, which should be better at towing, isn't, because it's a V6, and Sprinter vans are just not configured for towing. I could not tow the Airstream legally or safely with the Sprinter. Some of you out there might be thinking, but Jeff, the solution is obvious to you. What you need to buy is a Chevy Express van, which gives you a van that can tow the Airstream. And it's absolutely true. Chevy Express vans generally have about 1,000 pounds of tongue weight they can hold and up to 10,000 pounds of towing. There's many different ways to configure them. But yeah, that's absolutely true. Then I would have a van that would do everything I want the van to do that would also tow the Airstream. And I might be getting 13 miles a gallon. And that is the problem. So this is also a future-proofing thing. I remember I bought a Land Rover back when gas was cheap, and that Land Rover got 11 miles per gallon on premium. Terrible, right? And at the time, that didn't matter. But that would have mattered recently. That would have mattered last year or the year before a whole heck of a lot. So anyway, I'm sorry to be rambling about this. It's just what I've been thinking about as I've been sitting on airplanes for the last couple weeks. I think I'm going to have to sell the ambulance. I'm going to have to build out a truck. So you guys are going to hear me talking about the realities of building out a truck soon. And when you're doing your own rig, do not overlook gas mileage. It is a huge, huge deal. And it could end up costing you more than anything else in your entire rig. Tech Talk. Hey, this Tech Talk is something I've talked about before, but because of all the different vehicles I've been in lately, I've been noticing this problem, so I'm going to reiterate because it's important. If you are building out your own van, you have probably purchased at least one battery-powered drill, or you've owned one, or, you know, whatever, but generally almost everybody has a battery-powered drill these days. This was not the case when I was a kid. Such things were of science fiction nature, but now everyone has a battery-powered drill. And that's fine, but the problem is that people tend to over-tighten things with their battery-powered drill. And I see this in the Airstream, where I can just look up at the ceiling and I can see where, like, there are some vents up there that are screwed into the ceiling. I can see where somebody has over-tightened some of the screws and kind of, like, not dented, but pushed in the vents in some places. And in my camper van, there's a screw that I over-tightened that's kind of cracking some plastic a little bit. And this is a big problem, actually. It's not a little problem. You have to remember that your vehicle, as you're traveling down the road, flexes and moves and shakes. And things that don't flex break. And if you have something over-tightened, any kind of energy that's added to that, whether it's shaking or vibration or whatever, if it can't move a little bit, it's going to crack. And this is especially true for plastic things. I know on the outside of my ambulance, there are what are called Whelan lights. They're action lights, the bright white halogen lights that you would use to light up a scene where there was an accident. And they have this plastic covers. And you take the covers off to replace the light bulb. This is not rocket science. But I can tell that whoever did that last screwed those in way too tight and actually broke the corners off. So it's easy enough to tell people not to over-tighten things with their battery drill, but how? Well, it turns out that drills are made for this. Unless you bought the cheapest drill on the planet, your drill has a clutch. The part that you put the bit in is called the chuck, you know, and you put the bit in and you hold on to it and you press forward on the trigger and that tightens it. That part you're holding on to, that's the chuck. And if you look at that chuck, it will almost always have numbers on it. Well, those numbers mean something. That's the clutch. And if you look at one end of the clutch, you will see what is probably a picture of a drill bit. And that's the setting for drilling, like drilling a hole. That turns the clutch off. But every other setting adds clutch all the way down to 0 or 1 or however yours is configured, where it takes very little energy for the drill to slip. And by slip, I mean, if you have a Phillips head screw bit in and you put it in the screw and press the trigger, it will stop tightening at a certain point. That's what the clutch is for, and that's what prevents over-tightening. So if you're screwing, say, a plastic bezel onto your Max Air fan, you probably want to have that clutch in the middle somewhere, whatever the scale is. If it's 1 to 20, you want to put it on 10. If it's 1 to 10, you want to put it on 5, somewhere around there. And what will happen is it will screw in that screw, and then when it meets a certain amount of resistance, it'll start slipping and it won't over-tighten the screw. It's kind of the way a torque wrench works, but nowhere near as precise. In some cases, the screw takes more energy to start than to tighten. In those cases, you would want to start it on the drill setting and then stop, adjust your clutch, and then finish it with the clutch. And one thing this does is for all your screws, if you set your clutch setting to a certain number, they will all be exactly the same level of tightness. And that's a good thing. It is, in many cases, better to under-tighten a screw than over-tighten a screw, because you can always tighten it more, but if it's over-tightened, you can damage things or strip out your screws, and that's bad. Now, nothing I've said here applies to tires or lug nuts or anything like that. That's a whole other thing. I'm just talking about screwing things into your rig, whether they're outlet covers or fan covers or whatever the heck you're screwing in. Always consider the clutch setting. And unless you are drilling a hole, your clutch should be set at some kind of a number. A lower number for a smaller screw in general. Product review. I thought I already talked about this, and I'm looking at my notes and I can't find it. So I'm going to talk about it again, because what the heck? I'm getting old. I get to talk about things more than once. That's part of the privilege of being old. So I like toast. I really like toast. And I've had a number of different camp toasters. And when I built out the NV200, I just basically had a one-burner stove, and I was trying all these different ways to make toast on that stove. And I bought the classic Coughlin camping toaster thing, which kind of worked, but you had like 2 seconds before your toast changed into charred bread. You had to be perfect and everything. You had to flip it, and it was kind of a pain. And finally, the thing I found that worked the best was actually to stick the piece of bread on a big fork and manually toast it over the flames. That honestly worked the best. But now I am all fancy. Mm-hmm. Because I have an electric toaster. I've actually got two. I've got one in the Tiki Bago, and I've got one in the ambulance. But as I've said many times, devices that create heat are really hard on your batteries, and you generally need really big batteries to make these work. But I found a toaster that works on just about any moderate size battery bank or permanent battery installation. It only uses 500 watts. Now, it is a 110-volt device. You will need to use an inverter for this if you are running it without shore power, which you probably are. Most toasters in your house are going to use 1100 watts. How does this thing do the same thing at 500 watts? And the answer is really stupid. It only does one slice of bread at a time. It's a one slice toaster. That's it. It's not made for travel. It's not made for vehicles or anything like that. It's just a one slice toaster. And you put the bread in and you push the lever down. And after 45 seconds or so, boom, your toast pops up and you're done. And I have used this on several different batteries now, and it works fine. And bonus, most of the time you're eating your toast in the morning, and that means you have the rest of the day to recharge your batteries. So if you have a little tiny battery you're using this on that can barely do 500 watts, like a Jackery 500, you've got all day to charge it. So that's a nice thing too. The toast it makes is just toast. It's plain old toast, and it's just like you'd make it at home in your regular toaster. Now, this is a slot toaster, not a toaster oven. So you're not going to put like your leftover chicken in this unless you're really clever. But honestly, folks, this is the solution. If you are a toastaholic, if there is such a thing, if you want to make toast like you are at home and you have the battery power for it, this is the thing to get. So this one that I like is just a plain, basic, simple black toaster. It's called an Elite Gourmet ECT118B. Cool touch, single slice toaster, 6 toasting levels with a wide slot for bagels, waffles, specialty breads, pastry, snacks. And it's black. And for me, this is good because I definitely want to be able to cook bagels. But here's the best part about this toaster. It's $12. It's $12.60. This is not a big investment. It weighs very little. But if you like toast, this is really a good thing to look at. So I'll have a link in the show notes. Any of these single slot toasters will probably work as I've described. Just make sure you check the wattage. 500 watts seems to be the magic number for most of these batteries. But this Elite Gourmet one, yeah, I've used it dozens of times. It's great. It just works. And boy, now I want a sandwich or something. Tales from the road. So I just came back from Africa. And I have a little bit of an ethical dilemma. Because the place I went to, I didn't choose. This was a very nice property. We were treated very nice. And, you know, I normally would recommend someplace like this. But we didn't choose it because we won it in an auction, so we had no idea what we were going to get. We wouldn't have chosen it because this organization that runs this safari camp supports another organization that I am diametrically opposed to. Now, I don't talk about politics and religion on this podcast, and I don't want to start that, but everybody, regardless of where you are on the spectrum, can imagine an organization that supports another organization that you definitely don't want to support. That's the situation I'm in. So I won't be mentioning the place, but I will talk a little bit about it. It was in Limpopo, if you want to look that up on a map. It's up in the northern part of South Africa. A beautiful, kind of a very rural part of the state. Lots of game driving camps up there. And it's in the Waterberg Massive Biosphere, which is this kind of ecological preserve. I mean, if you're going to go to South Africa, this is a great part of South Africa to get to. It's about a 4-hour drive north from Johannesburg if you fly in there. But this place that I went to did not have what is called the Big Five. And everybody wants to see the Big Five. The Big Five are animals that were notoriously hard to hunt. That's where they got their name from. And let's see, if I remember them correctly, they are lions, leopards, elephants, Cape buffaloes, and the rhino. And because they didn't have all these animals on their property, they offered excursions to another property that had them. So, and we went over to this property, and well, this property is kind of famous, it turns out. Now, this was not where I was staying. In fact, no one's staying at this property because it's out of business. But the animals are still there, so they will have game drives in there. And it's called Legends. And it's a famous, or it was a famous golf course in northern South Africa. And we didn't know anything about it. We just knew we were going to go drive around and chase lions, which we didn't actually see any. But we certainly saw elephants. Yes, we did. Anyway, we get there. And it's this incredibly fancy kind of country club golf course place with these massive African-style brick walls and absolutely beautiful until we got through the gate. And then it turned into a scene from the game Fallout. It was weirdly abandoned, and yet some of the stuff still worked. And we got out of the van and they said, hey, if anyone wants to use the bathrooms, there's some bathrooms in the second building over there that kind of work. Don't use these. They don't work. We were basically in this abandoned property and just kind of wandering around, and there wasn't any electricity, or there was only some electricity, and the water kind of worked. And it was the strangest thing. And it took a moment and was talking to my wife about, like, where are we? We're in rural South Africa at an abandoned country club. And yeah, that's exactly where we were. And the people who were driving us told us that this Legends golf course, and you can look this up, it's pretty easy to Google, was this big fancy golf course. All these famous people played there. In fact, they had some of the most famous golfers in the world design the different holes. And then it's one of the few golf courses in the world with 19 holes on its course. If you're not a golf person, most courses have either 9 or 18 holes, 18 holes being considered a professional course. This one has 19. And it was called the Extreme 19 because the 19th hole required you to use a helicopter. You would actually get into a helicopter and fly to the top of a mountain that was several thousand feet tall. So, I mean, 2,000 feet up there. And that's where the tee was. That's where you hit the ball from. And you would hit the ball from the top of this mountain and aim for the green, that's where the hole is, down in the valley. So imagine you're driving off of a mountain, and the idea is that you're aiming for the hole way down in the valley. I don't even know how you'd see the ball. They must have spotters. And this was a thing they offered at this golf course, is that after you finish your 18, you could do the Extreme 19 and fly up there. I mean, what an absolutely crazy thing. In my understanding, it cost a few hundred dollars to do this. And because of that, they let you hit like five balls so you could use your best ball, which to me is cheating. But anyway, that's where we were. Now, we weren't there to play golf, obviously. We were there to chase animals. So after we kind of got organized in the abandoned golf course clubhouse thing, we headed off in, let's see, what vehicles were we in? We were in Land Cruisers this time. So Land Cruisers in South Africa are different than they are in the U.S. A Land Cruiser in the U.S. is kind of a fancy station wagon kind of vehicle. You know, it's enclosed. Down there, they're less fancy pickup truck kind of vehicles, and they mount seats in the back. So imagine a pickup truck that had like stadium seating mounted to the back that faced forward, and you could fit like 12 people in these. This is the normal thing you do for safaris in South Africa. And we headed out to chase all these animals, and we found a good number of them. We definitely saw elephants up close, and boy, there's a whole lot to say about elephants. That's a very complicated topic. It turns out that elephants are not good for properties down there, and people have a lot of trouble with them. But we saw elephants, we saw Cape buffaloes, we saw leopard tracks. Leopards are the hardest animal to see. We saw black and white rhinos, which is extremely rare. We didn't, however, see any lions, and that's okay. We had seen them before, not a big deal. But something rather remarkable happened on this trip that still blows my mind. Now, remember where I said we were? We're at an abandoned golf course. And we're basically in the fields surrounding this abandoned golf course, something like 100,000 acres of land. And it's a scrubby forest with tall grasses, and you can't really see anything. And at any moment, a lion could be watching you. You know, you were never allowed to get out of the vehicle. And as we're driving around here, I noticed the woman behind me is getting a little uncomfortable. And her husband was sitting up front. And she kind of whispered to him, past me, "Hey, I really need to go to the bathroom." I felt terrible for her because what the heck are you going to do? Go squat in the bushes and hope there's not a lion there? I don't know. The husband, much to his discredit, decided to make this a public thing and let everybody know in, I don't know, I think that could have been handled differently. But the driver seemed rather nonplussed, and I thought, okay, well, this probably happens fairly often. The driver has a plan. And this was mentioned when we had an elephant like 10 feet from the vehicle. And the elephant was looking at us as it ate a tree, which is what elephants do. They eat trees. And I'm like, okay, well, I would like to help. There's nothing I can do in this situation. I'm just going to watch and see what happens. And the driver says, in his African accent, "Ma'am, you need to use a restroom." And she said, "Yes, please," quite urgently. In fact, she was in some distress. And he said, "Okay." Didn't say anything, didn't give any instructions. He just said, "Okay." And we sat there for another 30 seconds. And he started the engine. And we started to drive away from the elephants. And we went up this little hill. This is in like 20 seconds later. Boom! There's a restroom! Like a full restroom. It's actually two restrooms, one for men, one for women, and picnic tables right there, right in the middle of this wilderness. It's like this guy conjured up a restroom. Like if you were playing one of these games where you build things like Fortnite or Minecraft or whatever, he pressed the build a bathroom button and placed it right there. I don't know. It perhaps impressed me too much, but to have exactly what you need in a place where you absolutely do not expect to find it really impressed me, and it sure impressed that woman too. She was quite pleased. Although then there was an incident that no one knew how to flush the toilets because they were apparently weird toilets where there was a separate water supply, and I didn't need to go. I didn't go look at them. But the driver said, don't worry about it. And we got back in the vehicle and went and chased some more buffalo. But anyway, yeah, how was that? All these experiences in Africa. And the thing that impresses me the most is a bathroom in the savannah. If bathroom in the forest for you is a biffy, I guess this is a bissy. Or maybe a bivy because it was in the veldt. This was actually the real veldt. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, that was what struck me when I was in South Africa. A place to visit. However, we're not done talking about Africa. Of course we're not. Folks, the first time I went to Africa, I took a group there, and we went to Johannesburg and visited Soweto, and then went to Kruger National Park, and we did kind of all that part of South Africa, which would be the eastern, more or less, part of east central part of North Africa, South Africa. So this time, since we flew into Johannesburg and we went up to Limpopo, and I was like, well, let's see if we can add on. So we added on a trip to Cape Town, and wow, I fell in love with Cape Town. I have a completely different idea of what South Africa is now, having seen Cape Town. Cape Town is one of these world cities that does not receive enough attention. I mean, you know what Athens looks like. You know what Rio de Janeiro looks like. You know what London looks like. You know what Paris looks like. You should know what Cape Town looks like. Everybody should know what Cape Town looks like, because Cape Town is very distinctive and really just amazing. Cape Town is completely dominated by this mountain called Table Mountain. It's over 3,000 feet tall. It's also 3,000 feet above sea level because Cape Town is on the coast. And you just basically have this 3,000-foot cliff looming over the entire city. And then on the other side is the ocean. And it's a wild ocean because it's near but not quite at the Cape of Good Hope, which is where the Indian Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean meet. It's beautiful and stunning. And I am going to try to just give you some tidbits, but I could speak for hours about Cape Town and how much I loved it. First off, food was incredibly inexpensive for Americans. The rand, the African, South African rand now was 18 to 19 to 1 for us. So we could get a really nice meal of steak and wine for about $15 a person. I mean, that was a very easy thing to do, and that was wonderful. The wine country was, sorry, California and Oregon and Washington State, you have nothing compared to South Africa. South Africa blows you away. Not only is the wine good, the wineries are lavish, and I have not been in more fancy places, I think, than a couple of these wineries in South Africa. Completely blown away by their beauty and how lavish they were. If you think there is a money dichotomy in the U.S. where there are a lot of rich people and a lot of poor people and not too many in the middle, South Africa, there's nobody in the middle. There's people making $10 a month, and then there's millionaires and billionaires. I mean, that's how it seems. I know it's not exactly like that. But these wineries were catering to the wealthy, wealthy folks, and we got to go there for some reason. I felt completely out of place, like, I am not worthy to be here. Unbelievable, just incredible vistas of rows of grapes with mountains and trees, and just absolutely beautiful. And the hotel we stayed at, which I will absolutely plug, folks, if you go to Cape Town, stay at the hotel called The Vineyard. Now, ironically, it's not where the vineyards are. When it was built in 1800, that's where the vineyards were. It's in the part of town called the Newlands. This is the, I don't know how to say it, but it's my favorite hotel I've ever stayed in my life. And folks, I've been to something like 77 countries. That is saying something. This hotel has trails and a river and just paths to walk through all these manicured forests. And anyway, if you can't tell, I really liked Cape Town. And Cape Town is a very modern city. There's a waterfront district and a shopping mall area that will look just like any, you know, like the waterfront in Baltimore or Miami. Or very familiar to Americans. And of course, if you go there, you have to see a bit of the history, and that is Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela and many, many others were incarcerated. It's not quite like Alcatraz, but it's the same concept, and if you take the ferry out there and tour Robben Island, they actually have inmates who will give you the tours and tell you what it's like. I mean, it's just really, really moving. Now, all that said, there's a very odd thing about Cape Town, and that is that their government's having trouble, as are many governments around the world. And one of the things they're having trouble with is keeping the lights on. Apparently, their power plants were built 50 years ago and haven't been upgraded since. And they're owned by the state, and the state won't put any money into them. And so, you know, we use a lot more electricity nowadays. So what they've decided to do is this thing called load shedding, which is exactly what it sounds like. They shed the load. So how do you shed the load if you're using too much power? Because, heck, folks in vans, we have this problem. Yeah, they turn the power off. That's it. They have rolling blackouts constantly, every day. It's a part of normal life. In fact, one of the restaurants we went to, on the menu, some of the items said LS next to them. And that meant those items weren't available during load shedding because they needed more power than their generator could provide to cook them. It was things like French fries, where they couldn't power the fryolators during load shedding. But a club sandwich you could get at any time. And it was just a normal part of life. We're sitting in the restaurant, the lights go out, and nobody stops what they're doing. The knives are still clanking on the silverware, the conversation still continues, people just simply light candles on the table and go about their normal business. And what's happening is that people who can afford it are all getting their own generators and solar power plants, and they're basically all living off-grid, even though there is a grid. So as much as I love Cape Town, things are not all perfect there. It's just, I don't know, it was a challenging place to be. I absolutely loved it, and I absolutely saw the economic disparity and realized I was taking part in that. While at the same time, I'm also pouring money into the economy that hopefully some of it gets to where it needs to go. I don't know. Very difficult to even think about the ethics in Africa, and I am just a baby in these regards. But if you are going to go to South Africa, I would highly recommend you go to Cape Town. Most of the safari-related activities center on Johannesburg, but Johannesburg as a city isn't all that great, although visiting Soweto was a really big deal. But Cape Town, one of my favorite cities I've ever visited, and I wish it wasn't 20 hours of flying away, because the jet lag can be brutal. Anyway, I'm not going to link any to anything, because you have to experience it for yourself, but yeah, Cape Town. I haven't even mentioned the penguins. There's penguins in Cape Town. You can walk down this trail and there's penguins just kind of flopping around on the beach, and you can walk around with them. And although my mother got bit by one, not on this trip, but on a different trip. So, you know, watch out. And Hyrax. I didn't mention the Hyrax. Anyway, there's too much to talk about, but I loved Cape Town, and I'm sorry for rambling so much. It's just, I haven't done a podcast in a month and I'm a little bit rambly. Real quick, resource recommendation. I know a lot of you are heading out to see the eclipse in a couple of weeks. I am. I'm going to go to Texas at some private event thing, so I can't invite you, unfortunately. But if you've not seen the eclipse before, it's one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen in your life. I highly encourage you to get out there and see it. And there isn't going to be another one for a long time, like 20 years. So this is the one to see. But protect your eyes. This is... you. Every time there's an eclipse like this, some people permanently damage their eyes, and I don't want that to be any of you. There are people out there selling fake sunglasses that are going to cause problems, and there's misinformation out there about using certain adjustable lens welding goggles that will not work because they won't adjust because the sun's too far away. Anyway, how do you know how to be safe? Well, I've got a link for you. It's from the American Astronomical Society. It is eclipse.aas.org/i-safety. I have the link in the show notes. They have the complete rundown of how to stay safe, how to check your glasses to make sure they're the right ones. You need your eyes. Van life without eyes is possible. There are people who can't see who are doing van life. My hat's off to them. But it's better to be able to see if you can. Try to preserve that. All that said, do get out and see the eclipse if you can. I saw the last one. I drove into this farmer's field in Missouri and absolutely loved it. And, you know, it's nice to be out in nature to see this, but Walmart parking lot's going to work just fine because it's going to be dark. You're not going to see much other than these jewels in the sky. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to this rather scattered episode. I apologize for that. I'm still jet lagged. That's my excuse. I'm going to go with it. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, you can find me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. Until next time, remember the words of Desmond Tutu, who said, "If you want peace, you don't talk to your friends. You talk to your enemies."